If we start with a little prayer. God, please help me to set aside everything that I think I know about myself, my illness, these steps, and especially you, for an open mind and a new experience with myself, my illness, these steps, and especially you. Amen.
Amen.
Well, my name is still Don. I'm still an alcoholic, fellow. We had broken earlier this afternoon and had just finished talking about the fourth step. But before I had a few words to say about the fifth step here, I wanted to go back to the fourth just real briefly, because this seems to be such a need and so much pressure to do a perfect fourth step. Adam, maybe it's because the wording of the steps is fearless and thorough and that sort of thing, but fearless and thorough obviously doesn't mean perfect, because right after the steps you've got the book saying that nobody has been able to adhere to any of those steps with anything near perfection. And the reason that's important to me is that I had trouble getting finished with my fourth step because I was afraid it wouldn't be thorough enough. Really, I was afraid it wasn't perfect. I was afraid I was going to leave something out. Mm-hmm. And what wound up being important to me was simply that it's better done than perfect, that I needed finally to bring an end to it. And Cherry kept telling me at the time, go ahead, Don. Wind the thing up. He said, you're not going to do a perfect one. No one ever has. And said, one of the big purposes of the tenth step is a safety net under the fourth step, that anything that you missed, you'll pick up in the tenth step when you continue to take personal inventory. Kind of the way he put it to me is, if I spent a whole day cleaning this houseboat just spick and span, but I left a dust bunny back there in a corner somewhere, and then I found that dust bunny, and I would say, oh my God, my whole cleaning project is down the drain. It's not of any value. And of course, Cherry's message to me is just pick up the dust bunny, throw it away, and go on. You know, just because you didn't do it perfectly doesn't mean that you didn't have the value there. One way of winding it up is frequently to go ahead and set an appointment with whoever's going to hear your fifth step, even though you're not done. And that will put build a fire under you to get it done. So those are thoughts that have been helpful in my experience about winding up the fourth step. Now, fifth step, admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. The Big Book has got quite a bit to say about telling our fifth step to somebody. The Big Book has not one word to say about listening to a fifth step. And I don't believe that's an accident at all. Don't believe it's an oversight, because I don't think as much to do. I think I've got an active part in somebody's inventory just because I've been chosen to listen to their fifth step, I think I've gotten way too big for my britches. And I think I'm trying to do something that I'm not qualified to do. First place, as far as who we take that part of the fifth step with, of course, again, when this book was written, there wasn't anybody in the world sober more than 3 years. But Bill talks about doing it with your clergyman if you're a Catholic, or he doesn't say Catholic, but if you belong to a religious denomination that requires confession, it just takes it as a foregone conclusion. Of course you will do that with your priest. You know, it doesn't say consider your priest, so of course you will do it with your priest. And then it talks about that we might use our doctor or our psychologist. Of course, it's not going to use word sponsor, because word sponsor is not used in the whole 164 pages, and it doesn't make any... Yeah, Dennis?
Could you back it up? I didn't get all that about the priest.
Okay, the book, in talking about who to give your fifth step to, Bill, and of course, a lot of things have changed, because when this book was written, nobody in the world had been sober more than 3 years. But the book talks about that if you're Catholic, that certainly you will do it with your priest. Then it says that you can consider your doctor, your psychologist. And then it mentions doing it with other friends of your acquaintance. But there's no indication at all that you must, or even that it's advisable to do it with another alcoholic. Now, I don't take that to mean that we shouldn't do it with other alcoholics and that we shouldn't do it with our sponsors. I have done mine with sponsors because things have changed an awful lot since the 1930s, because we now have sponsors who have got many years of sobriety. When this book was written, if they had suggested that you do it with somebody in the program, it could have caused a lot of messes, because you'd been giving people that hadn't been sober but a year or two all kinds of damaging information about yourself that could cause you real problems in your life. And our situation is not exactly that, but do be aware that the book doesn't even seem to contemplate doing the fifth step with another alcoholic. Now, the step itself is a three-part step, and that's so easy to miss, because we think in terms of when we have gone and talked to another human being about it, we have done the fifth step. Fact is, the step is real clear, that we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And it's the exact nature, it's not the particular facts of our wrongs. You know, if I've robbed 32 liquor stores, I don't need to detail the time and place and who was with me on every one of those robberies. All I need to do to admit the exact nature of my wrongs is admit that I had a pattern of sticking a gun under somebody's nose and taking their money from their place of business. That's admitting the exact nature of my wrong. I don't have to give them all the details of it, but in my experience, I have never felt like it was necessary to look in a mirror and read my whole inventory to admit it to myself. And I've never felt like it was necessary to get down on my knees and read the whole inventory to admit it to God. But now what I have done, and I've done this consistently, is I look in that mirror with that inventory in my hand, and I say, Don, this is you. You know, you're not hiding from this anymore. Don't try to hide from it. This is it. And I've done that same thing on my knees with God. I've said, you know, Father, you already knew all this anyway. You know far more about it than I do, but I just want to say that I'm not trying to hide anything from you. You know, this is best and tell is me. And there it is, Dad. You know, do with it what you will. And then I've done the other two-thirds of that step. Physically doing fifth steps. Again, going back to the person that's listening to it, I'm not saying that I don't ever say anything, but I'm saying that I don't need to be taking it over. You know, my job is to listen. And the most effective thing I can do is use the 11th step for myself. And sit there and pray, Thy will be done. I'm no longer running the show. And Lord, please let me seek to love, comfort, and understand Mac rather than be loved, comforted, and understood by him. Lord, please let me seek to love, comfort, and understand Mac rather than seeking to be loved, comforted, and understood by Mac. And what that does for me, you talk about a miracle. That does something for me that I can't do for myself. It makes me what I'm not. It makes me a listener. See, I'm not by nature a listener. But if I'll use that 11th step and say those prayers, it makes me able to really listen to you under any circumstances. And I think I mentioned last night talking about something else. If I won't listen to you, it's extremely unlikely that I can tell or show you anything that'll do any good at all. The first step of helping, being helpful to anybody, is my willingness and my ability to listen to them. If I won't do that, I can't be of much use to them. But at any rate, there's been a lot of conversation about whether you can break your fifth step up and do part of it with this one and part of it with that one. My reading of the step, it seems usually to be talking about one person, although it makes a reference to you might want to do this part of it with somebody. So I don't know that it's a great big deal. Brian Jim, who you remember, Gene, Jim Walt, who died, I guess, six, 8 years ago. Jim's mm-hmm. been gone a while from New Albany. But Brian Jim had something to say about that impressed me, and I've adopted it for me. Jim's sponsor had died after he'd done his fifth step and raised another question. You've done it, and the person you did it with is dead. Do you need to do it again? Well, Jim said that after praying about it and talking to some folks, he came to the conclusion that there needed to be one other living human being walking this earth who knew everything significant, bad about him that there was to know. That he just felt like that was of value to have that one living human being walking the earth that knew that. And I've adopted that. The book doesn't say that. And I'm just telling you what's worked for me, that I'm more comfortable having one human being that knows it all rather than picking and choosing, and I'll tell Gene about this, and I'll tell Ed about that, and Matt about that, and Mac about that, and Joe about that, and Chuck about that, and Riley about that. I ain't going to tell Marco nothing over there, but I'll tell Dennis that. and I'm just not comfortable for me doing it that way. The physical part of listening to it, I always ask people, how many pages have you got written? And the reason for that's extremely practical, so we can schedule the time to do it. You know, that's helpful to know if a person's got 3 pages, and I've seen some inventories that seem to work just fine that were 2 or 3 pages long, and I've seen some inventories that seem to work just fine that were 2 briefcases long.
Yeah.
I literally did one time that took 27 hours over a weekend. Guy'd been working on this inventory for 8 years, I guess, and hadn't been able to find anybody that appropriate to do it, and flew into Louisville, and we spent 27 hours that weekend. What we finally had to do, from the physical standpoint, it seems to me there are 3 ways you can do it, basically. Either the person who's written the inventory can hold it and read it to you, or the person who's written the inventory can hold it and paraphrase it to you, you know, just talk about it to you, or the two of you can actually look at it and read it to yourselves together, and the one who has written the inventory can point out anything that they want to elaborate on, and if the person who's listening to the fifth step has got any questions, they can say, what does this mean, Gene, down here where you, what was this about dead chicken again, down here? And I don't know that any one of those 3 ways is better than any other, and I always tell the person who's going to do their fifth step with me, I tell them that, you know, seems like to me there are 3 ways we can do it. Do you have a preference? I don't. With the longer ones, like the one that took 27 hours, we would still have been working on that. And that was 3 or 4 years ago, and we'd still been working on that fifth step if we hadn't wound up doing it by laying it out and he and I both reading it and him pointing out and me asking the questions, just simply because of the time. He's not from here. He's from a lot of states away, and he had a plane to catch, and we weren't going to finish it. So sometimes just the press of time needs us to do that. Well, once we have done that, we've got some real nice fifth step promises on page 75. Middle paragraph says, once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, number one, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. Now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come. often comes strongly. We feel we're on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. So pretty neat promises. Now, when I finished my fifth step with Cherry Carpenter, I really didn't feel some of all these things were there. But as far as me feeling, it wasn't the huge, immediate relief that I felt that I had anticipated that it would be. In fact, I walked away from there feeling kind of drained and feeling kind of wrung out and kind of anticlimactic. And I mentioned that to Cherry, and he explained to me that didn't make a big difference in the world, that I had done or attempted to do what I was supposed to do and not worry about how I felt about it, that I'd gotten in an awful lot of trouble putting my value judgments on events in my life, and I didn't need to be putting any value judgments on it. Just do what the book said and go right on. Now, having done it, before we move on here, you know, if you sit around again in discussion meetings and listen to people talking about doing the steps, sometimes you'll get the impression that having done a fourth step inventory and a fifth step is having done the steps. And there's a big tendency to stop after we've done the fifth step, you know, to take a breather. Well, what happens is that so many times, you know, we'll do the fifth step, and we'll be told by whoever we done it, did it with, or we know in the book exactly what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to go home, and we'll get to that in a minute when we start talking about 6 and 7, and go right on with 8 and 9. But we don't do it. And I've seen it happen so many times. Somebody's done their fifth step with me, and then 2 months or 6 months or 2 years later, they're talking to him and said, "Don, I don't understand. This hasn't worked. I not only am not any more comfortable, I'm worse off than I was before I did steps 4 and 5. Of course they are. Of course they're worse off if they hadn't gone on with the rest of the steps. Because all 4 and 5 do, and this is an ugly comparison, but it's the best one that I've ever been able to articulate. In 4 and 5, we dig up all these decomposing corpses in all sorts of different stage of decomposing. And we've got them strewn all over our lives. We've had them buried, you know, not buried properly, but we've had them buried, some of them for a long, long time. But in 4 and 5, we have dug those suckers up. And we're stepping over them everywhere we go. And, of course, until we go ahead and proceed with 6 through 9, which is the process that gets those decomposing corpses properly reinterred, of course, until we've done that, we're more uncomfortable than we were before we did our 4th and 5th step. So the 4th and 5th step, in my experience, don't stand on their own feet at all. Even if I'm going to inventory a single event that's happened in my life, and I do that, I don't need to just write it down and go tell somebody. I need to take that through 6, 7, 8, and 9, because that's the only way I'm going to get the relief on it when I expose it to the whole process. So don't stop after 5. There can be a pretty high price for that stopping. Now, once we finish 5, this is another place where Bill's just getting real specific about what you do. He tells you where to go. He tells you what to do. He tells you how long to take doing it. The book says on 75, right after fifth step promises, it says, "Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet." So we return home. We find a place at home that's quiet. For an hour. Carefully reviewing what we've done, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better, and I see that as a specific prayer that I am told to do, that I am to pray, "God, I thank you from the bottom of my heart that I know you better." And then it says, "I take this book down from the shelf, and I spend this hour going through the first 5 steps and making sure that I haven't skimped on anything, that I've done it to the best of my ability right then." once I have done that, it tells me how important that it is, because we're right back to that arch that we were talking about in the third step. It says we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man, and we want to make sure that all of our work is solid and we haven't left anything out. Now, once we have done that, then, fellas, we get to the less than half a page that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous devotes to step 6 and 7. That's the top, page 76. It devotes two fairly short paragraphs to step 6 and 7. And after I'd done my fifth step with Cherry, I went back to my attic, and I spent an hour with my big book going over steps 1 through 5.
Thank you.
I thanked God from the bottom of my heart that I knew God better. I did the best I could with getting willing to have God remove from me everything that was objectionable. And then I got on my knees and I said this prayer that is the seventh step prayer on page 76. And according to the big book, that's all I'm supposed to do at this point. Now, you guys probably have figured out already this weekend that I depend just about totally on the big book for myself. I don't have anything against the 12 and 12, although personal experience, this is my experience has led me to believe that Bill Wilson was inspired by God when he wrote this book, without a doubt. I'm not so sure Bill Wilson was inspired by God when he wrote all the 12 and 12. You know, he wrote a lot of good stuff in there and put a lot of knowledge in it. But I haven't found the divine perfection in the 12 and 12 generally that I've found in the big book. And I've got a 12 and 12 right in there. I read out of it every morning as part of my morning meditation. So don't take this as any knocking of the 12 and 12. I'm just saying it may not be the perfectly divine work that this one is. And that's not knocking it. But with regard to step 6 and 7, I have found the 12 and 12 to be real, real helpful. Because it's a real good discussion of step 6 and 7 in the 12 and 12. Now, what happened to me is that I blew on past 6 and 7, and I sort of had this idea that 6 and 7 were like some game that they used to advertise, that you could learn it in minutes, but it took a lifetime to master it. And I had the idea that it was going to be that way, that 6 and 7 were something that were just going to sort of happen to me after I'd said that seventh step prayer. And what happened is that I went through the first 9 years of my sobriety, and I thought that when I had done my inventory, well, I had, when I did my inventory, I formed a picture of what a spiritual Don Major would look like. I really did, you know, and I got some very clear ideas of those character defects that didn't agree with this picture of a spiritual Don Major that I had in my head. And I believed with all my heart that it was my job, with God's help. Now, I did have it that far, that I had to have some help from God. I believed with all my heart that the sixth and seventh step were where, with God's help, I went to work on those character defects that were inconsistent with the picture of a spiritual Don that I had formed. And I thought that was not only my right, I thought it was my responsibility. I thought anything else would be irresponsible. And, Lord, I would pray for those character defects that were so clearly inconsistent with what a spiritual Don would look like to be gone. And I'd pray every day. And every day, as part of my morning meditation, I'd read on page 87, where it says, many of us wasted a lot of time praying for our own selfish ends, and it didn't work. You could easily see why. It took me 9 years to begin to understand that I was praying for my own selfish ends. I had just dressed it up in spiritual clothes. Mm-hmm. Well, now, the first 9 years of my sobriety were wonderful years. They really were. They were wonderful years. My life was, I was rocketed into that fourth dimension of existence. My life was so much better than I ever dreamt life would be. Lord, I got my law license back. I got my daughter back. I got the respect of my colleagues back. I began to get material things back. My life in AA started rolling beautifully. I wound up, by God incidents, talking at the Kentucky State Convention when I was sober 22 months. People started asking me to talk here and talk there and be their sponsor. And during those first 9 years, all those things were going so beautifully. But the first 9 years of my sobriety, fellows, relationships with the opposite sex and financial chaos like to have killed me. They like to have eaten me completely up. And my Lord, I worked so hard on relationships with the opposite sex and financial chaos. And I was doing what I thought was the only responsible thing for me to do, working on my character defects. Now, I want to tell you something. I didn't want anything wrong. I didn't want a bunch of women. All I wanted was just a sane, comfortable, monogamous relationship with one decent woman where she and I could go on about our business and my life wouldn't be torn all to pieces by strife with the opposite sex all the time. There's certainly nothing wrong with that. And in the financial end, I didn't want wealth. Just really didn't want. I didn't want new Corvette convertibles, Rolex watches, and that sort of stuff. I did not want. All I wanted was for the craziness to stop, for the chaos to stop. That's truly all I wanted. So there's nothing wrong with those objectives. And the tools I was using to work on those things, I was using rigorous honesty. I was using prayer. I was using the steps. I was using sponsors. I was using meetings. I was using outside counseling when it seemed appropriate. And for 9 years, those two parts of my life seemed like they got markedly worse every week. And I didn't know what was wrong. Well, Cherry Carpenter had died about 8 years ago right now. Cherry remained my primary sponsor even after I moved from Nashville. I moved from Nashville when I was 21 months sober back to Louisville. Went back into law practice. But I kept Cherry as my primary sponsor, even though he was in Nashville and I was in Louisville. And Cherry died, and I felt a real emptiness there because Bernie F., which a lot of you guys know in Louisville, I got Bernie to be a sponsor for me practically as soon as I moved back to Louisville in 83. And Bernie's been my sponsor ever since. And as far as I'm concerned, Bernie will be my sponsor as long as we both live in. But Bernie and I became friends. We became close. And Bernie got where he just really liked me and loved me. And if I go to dear sweet Bernie with a problem in my life, say if it's a financial problem, poor Bernie is apt to love me and like me so much he starts trying to help me figure out how to get the money. And see, I don't need that. I need what I got from Cherry Carpenter. I need, I see, that's part of living. Said, Don, any time you make a big deal out of anything that's not God in these 12 steps, what you're really making a big deal out of is yourself. And when you do that, you're back in the ego and you're back in the outcome. So, Cherry, you don't understand. We're talking about my health here. And Cherry would say, yes, Don, I understand. Any time you make a big deal out of anything that's not God in these 12 steps, what you're making a big deal out of is yourself. I said, Cherry, you don't understand. We're talking about me maybe going to the penitentiary here. Yeah, Don, I understand. Any time you make a big deal out of anything that's not God in these 12 steps, what you make a big deal out of is yourself. You're back into ego and you're back into accuracy. But, Cherry, we're talking about my daughter, son. You know, that's holy. That's God-like. Yeah, I understand, Don. Anytime you make a big deal out of anything that's not God in the 12 steps, what you make a big deal out of is yourself. And I need that. And Bernie liked me and loved me too much to be able to give me that. So I figured I needed to replace Cherry as my authority figure sponsor. And talked at a little conference up in Indiana in April, in Danville, Indiana, outside Indianapolis, in April of 1990. And Tom B. from Cleveland, Ohio, actually, his tapes say Avon Lake, which is a little suburb of Cleveland there. But Tom B. talked there, too, and I really liked Tom. I liked what he said. He and I had breakfast on Sunday morning before we left, and I said, Tom, will you be one of my sponsors? And Tom said, yeah. And I said, Tom, I don't know what's wrong. Said, it's awful. I stand up in these rooms all over this country giving these AA talks. I sponsor all these people, and I feel like I do some good. And I really don't feel like I'm being dishonest, but Tom, I'm dying. This relationship with the opposite sex thing, Lord, I'd run through two bad marriages in sobriety. Well, I ran through one unfortunate marriage and one bad marriage in sobriety. I had made just about every mistake. That's why at page 70 that I was talking about what happens if we fall short of the chosen ideal in sexuality. That's why it's so important to me, because I'm not aware of many sexual mistakes that I could have made that I didn't make sober, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have to pick up a drink. I had a world of pain, but I apparently had enough willingness to be forgiven and taken on to something better that I didn't have to drink, that I fell into that category. But I explained to him how the financial chaos and the relationships with the opposite sex, they were making me so uncomfortable, and they were interfering with my spirituality so much. And I just knew they were. You know, and I thought they were interfering with my usefulness to other people. And God, they were embarrassing me. You know, I mean, they were just, it was really embarrassing to have all that mess going on. And it seemed so inconsistent with the rest of my life. So Tom said, yeah, come on up and see me, and we'll talk about it. So in May of 1990, I followed up on that, and I went up to spend a weekend with Tom, flew to Cleveland. And they had a golf tournament there that weekend, an AA golf tournament. I don't play golf, never played golf in my life, but it was a Cleveland-Akron AA joint golf tournament. And Tom had been sober, I believe, 29 years at that time. And these old boys treated him like a newcomer. There was one old boy there that weekend who had drank with Dr. Bob. And we didn't get out of the airport. Now, get this picture. I'm 9 years sober. I've been a convention speaker for years. I'm sponsoring somewhere around 40, 50 people. I've listened to over 50 fifth steps. We didn't get out of the airport before those old guys started saying things like, all sober about 9 or 10 years. That's about the time most folks begin to look at steps 6 and 7. Right. And, of course, my reaction to that was, my God, these guys don't know who they're talking to. And then Tom made, I knew I'd made a terrible mistake on my sponsor, on my choice of new sponsor, because I had so many concrete problems. You know, just my butt was on fire, and I needed concrete solutions. And Tom gave me a hug as soon as he saw me and said, well, Don, glad to see you. And he said, you know, whatever it is you came up here looking for, you already have, merely because you're willing to seek it. And I thought, oh, my God. You know, I'm nearly dead and needing some concrete problems, and I'm getting this crap. Well, what developed out of that weekend is that by the time I got ready to go home on Sunday, some realization had started. It's very important to me, the difference between knowing and realizing. Mm-hmm. Because, see, there are things that I've known for years that weren't real to me. And I'm supposed to be a wordsmith, you know. I've made my way through life with words all my life. And it's just been within the last several years that it's even dawned on me that the word realize is a form of the word real. That's all it is. It's just another form of the word real. And when I have realized something, it has become real to me. It has become real to me. And that's so different from knowing. Because, you see, for years before I went to Cleveland that weekend, I knew every word this book says about the 6th and 7th step, knew most of the words that 12 and 12 say about it. And I could have quoted the 7th step prayer to you backwards. If you'd given me 10 minutes and sat down at a table with me, I could have started with the last word and worked backwards through that prayer. And as far as knowing what the words were, I knew what it said, but I didn't realize what it said. See, I thought that prayer asked God to remove all my defects of character, or at the very least, to remove all the defects of character that I had found offensive and that were making me uncomfortable. It's not what it says, fellas. The prayer asked God to remove each and every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to God and my fellows. And folks, I don't know which ones they are. And it was an arrogant mistake that caused me many, many years of unnecessary discomfort that I assumed that I knew which defects in my character were standing in the way of my usefulness to God and my fellows. And I want to tell you something. I don't know whether I'm helping any of you guys this week, and I know I'm not. And I don't know whether God's helping any of the rest of y'all through me, but I hope God is. And if God is helping any of you all, you can bet your bippies that I would never have been asked to be down here. I would not be doing this except for the character defects that have stayed with me so long in sobriety and that I've had such public pain concerning them. And I've made so many mistakes and I've screamed at God to get rid of them and they haven't been taken away. But somehow I managed to keep on stumbling. I managed to keep on one day at a time not taking a drink or dope and keep coming back and trying to do, and those things got better. And that's why I've got something to share. And do you think it was in my mind, oh, God's working on me, I'll just stay around here and be miserable and embarrassed about this broad thing and this money thing, and I'll do it happily during those years? No, I was grabbing that character defect by the corner and slamming it up against the wall, saying, come here, God, I got him cornered. Give me a little help, we'll get rid of him. And God never came. And that picture I had in my head of what I ought to be, that I thought I not only was entitled to have, that I was obligated to have, nothing in the world but another self-determined objective. And if you really read the 12 and 12, the first line when it starts talking about the sixth step is that this step separates the men from the boys. And I'd wondered, well, why in the world is that? It doesn't seem like much of a big deal to me. In fact, I kind of thought that 10 steps were all they really were, that Bill just wanted a filler because he wanted 12 or something, that there had been another way to handle that other than making two steps out of that, for heaven's sake. But what it turned out was that I had the whole thing backwards on it. The 12 and 12 makes it clear, if you will read for the simplicity of it, later on it tells you what separates the men from the boys. What separates the men from the boys is the willingness to let go of our self-determined objectives regardless of how spiritual we think those objectives are. Just because I've dressed my self-determined objective up in spiritual clothes doesn't change its nature as a self-determined objective. For me to pray for a character defect to be gone because I want it gone and it's making me uncomfortable and it's inconsistent with what I think I ought to be is exactly the same spiritual mistake as me praying for a bright red Ferrari. You know, if I do that, one's not apt to show up in the driveway the next morning. And for me to pray for that character defect to be gone because I want it gone, and it's inconsistent with what I think I ought to be, says that what separates the men from the boys is willingness to trade in all those self-determined objectives for the perfect objective of God. And what that's wound up meaning to me has got to do with my relationship with perfection. See, all my life, drinking and the first 9 years sober, I thought I clearly understood what was wrong with me with regard to perfection. It was my inability to attain perfection. And guys, that has never even been an issue. Certainly, I'm incapable of attaining perfection, but we never got that far because I've got a much more basic problem. I can't recognize perfection. You see, if God gave me all of the power in the universe to become anything that I thought I should become right this minute, I'd be like a bland dog in a meat house. I wouldn't have any idea on earth what I should become. I wouldn't know how to use that power. So once I began to understand this idea that I'd been carrying around in my head for 9 years, and that I just thought it was a terrible thing because I couldn't get God to conform me to what I thought I ought to be because I had decided this was a spiritual tongue, I needed to let go of that altogether. It turned out 6 and 7 weren't where I went to work on my character defects to become what I thought I ought to be with God's help. 6 and 7 were where I stopped working on my character defects. And 6 and 7 were where I gave up an idea of what I ought to be and went back really to that third step decision and said, Dad, I don't know how we got here, and I don't know where we are, and I sure don't know where we're supposed to go, and I certainly don't have any idea how to get there. But I'm going to go back one more time to the only thing I can ever do, and that's try to do that next right thing, which is taking a step at a time along with you. And wherever you lead me, I guess will just have to be all right. Now, there were several things that I found out from those guys that weekend. Number one, you don't have to wait until you're sober 9 or 10 years to confront what 6 and 7 really are. It just happens that most folks, if they just go flying past them somewhere between 8 and 12 years, they'll usually hit that brick wall. You know, they'll usually run dead into the wall, and it seems to happen closer to 9 than most times in my experience. Also, one of my first objections is, my God, with the trouble I've had with these character defects working on them this hard, if I quit working on them, think of what a mess I'll have. And they said, now, Don, when you quit trying to control your drinking and turned your drink problem over to God, did you give yourself permission to take a drink if you wanted a drink? I said, no. Said, your part of that was to do that next right thing, to make that daily commitment not to drink or take dope even if your butt fell off. And God took care of the rest of it. Said, your part of this deal is you've got to pull back in and try real hard to do that next right thing. Said, if you'll do that, and they said, it's the third step all over again. You try and control the patterns. Said, that picture of a spiritual Don is nothing in the world but a pattern that you're trying to control. Said, let go of that. Go back. Said, anytime you think this deal is more complicated than doing the next right thing instead of the next thing you want to do, call us because you're confused. They said, you go back to Louisville. And I said, wait a minute. Y'all talk about sainthood here, boys. I'm not saintly enough to not care whether I'm spiritual. And I'm not saintly enough to not care whether I'm comfortable or whether I'm embarrassed or whatever. And I'm not metaphysical enough to give up any idea in my head of what I ought to be and just say, lead me anywhere you want me to. They said, Don, that's fine, but what you mean is that you can't feel that way, and that's not what we're talking about. They said, you go back to Louisville and you act like a fellow would act. If a fellow really didn't have any idea what he ought to be or how to get there, but was just real, real willing to do that next right thing and trust that God would take him wherever he was supposed to be, said, you go back and act like a fellow that felt that way and it'll work just fine. So I went back to Louisville and started that stumbling and falling, sometimes, as I say, 100 times a day. And I want to tell you that the last 7.5 years of my life, it seems like the 6th and 7th step have been right at the middle of it. The miracles, Lord, it wasn't 30 days when I got back to Louisville that I re-ran into Sharon, who is my wife now, and I wasn't trying to fix anything. I wasn't trying to fix a darn thing. I really and truly was trying my best just to do it the way the boys had told me up there, to let go of the pattern. Quit trying to fix myself and just do that next right thing with her. I did use that love, comfort, and understand deal on her, and that's a real, real effective trick to use on anybody, because it's real hard to keep from loving somebody when they're praying, Lord, please let me seek to love, comfort, and understand this person rather than to be loved, comforted, and understood by her. It's the most beautiful paradox in the world. When I will pray that, and when that prayer begins to take effect, and when I really do begin to let go of whether I get loved, comforted, and understood, and see, that's such a change, because all my life I thought we couldn't even begin to communicate until I got you to understand me.
Right.
And then after I got you to understand me, I'd work on getting you to love and comfort me.
Right.
And prayer tells me that doesn't have anything to do with anything. And when I really pray that and let go of it, it's one of those beautiful paradoxes. That's the only time that I wind up loved, comforted, and understood beyond my wildest dreams. Beyond my wildest dreams. And the minute I decide I like that and I start demanding it again and I start trying to get people to love, comfort, and understand me, it seems like they just sort of wander off. And I don't get it. And it isn't until I let go. But at any rate, Sharon and I have been together since about 30 days after I got back from Cleveland. And all I did was quit trying to fix myself. The financial thing went a little slower. Did any of you guys ever try to turn anything over to God with one hand while you were being less than rigorously honest in a systematic way with the other one?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the idea that I need to be rigorously honest with the Internal Revenue Service is an insane idea. That's clearly an insane idea. It was an insane idea in May of 1990, and it's an insane idea as far as my brain is concerned today. But there was something in my heart that kept nagging at me about that, that even though it didn't make any sense to be as rigorously honest with the Internal Revenue as I need to be with you folks, and even though I had the most compelling reasons why I couldn't afford to be, I mean, I had absolute compelling reasons why in my special position I couldn't afford to be, it didn't feel right. At the time, got to be my sponsor sometime, a little less than I expect it was in 91. Tom and I met in Columbus, Ohio for lunch. And as far as I can remember, the Internal Revenue was never mentioned. And whatever problem I went up there to discuss with Tom, and I don't remember whatever it was, it didn't have anything to do with the Internal Revenue, and Tom didn't say one word about the Internal Revenue. But that's the way this always works for me. It's the problem. Not only is the solution never what I think it is, the problem's never what I think it is. You know, so I need to put my brain out of it and just follow the instructions, do what I'm supposed to do, and let God do the healing. So I went up and met with Tom, and on the way back it hit me. You know, I've been standing up in these rooms and talking about rigorous honesty all these years. Maybe I'll try that with Internal Revenue. And I started overriding my brain's veto, and I still have to override my brain's veto. Because my brain still tells me that's the silliest idea I've heard of in my life. But about 5 or 6 years ago, I started overriding my brain's veto. And fellas, I can't tell you the economic miracle in my life. And I'm not aware of one single thing that I've done differently, other than start doing something that I knew in my heart was the next right thing when my brain was telling me it was absolute disaster. When I began that in 91 or 92, I still had over $100,000 worth of tax liens on me. I couldn't own a home. I had all sorts of other debts, still paying on debt that I had when I'd gotten sober, you know, 10 years before then. In that last 5 or 6 years, all that old debt is gone. All the old taxes are paid. My wife and I have got a beautiful home that's more beautiful than anything I ever dreamt that I could have. And I'm not saying this bragging because I didn't do it. I already told y'all how hard I tried. I've got mutual funds and retirement accounts. I've got two Harleys paid for. I've got a 98 Corvette convertible and all these things. And all I did was quit cheating the government. All the world I changed was I quit cheating the government. And I started doing that next right thing, and I quit trying to fix my finances. I quit trying to figure out how to fix my finances. I acted like a fellow would act that had just laid down at God's feet. And here's the real good news. Seemed like I was doing it about as poorly as a person could do it. seems like I'd fail on that six or seven step 2 dozen times every day and have to remember, oh, yeah, I'm supposed to be trying to do it this way. And it worked just fine because I was willing to get up and dust myself off and remind myself and just keep on stumbling. My God seems to be just real happy with that stumbling. And winding up on six and seven and how truly important they've been to me. If when I was in Cleveland in May of 1990, if God had said, Don, I have really listened to all this whining I care to hear. And there is a pencil and a piece of paper. And I want you to write down exactly what you want in your relationship with opposite sex. And I want you to write down exactly what you want in your financial life. And what you want in your law practice. And what you want in your life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what you want in your friends. And what you want in your relationship with your daughter. And while you're at it, write down the house you want to live in, the car you want to drive, and the clothes you want to wear. And I'd made that list 9 years sober, guys, in May of 1990. And I'd handed that list to God of my self-determined objectives, of the best that I was able to even contemplate that I would like to have. And God had said, here, St. Pete, give this yap those things now. I'm tired of his mouth. And God had given me just precisely what I thought I wanted. And please believe me, I'm not exaggerating. I would have shortchanged myself sadly on every single thing on that list. On every single thing on that list, the best that I could come up with in my little self-determined objective was just so far short of what my God has got in mind, when I will be still and let him be God and quit trying to engineer my recovery. See, that's what I was doing. I would have denied the high heaven I was trying to engineer my recovery, but certainly I was trying to engineer it. I was trying to make myself into what I thought I ought to be, instead of being willing to trade in all those self-determined objectives. And my self-determined objectives for that time were pretty noble. I had them dressed up pretty good, fellas, you know. But by acting like I was willing to turn those in, my God gave to me things that I truly, in every area of my life, in what I would call the spiritual area and what I would call the material area, my God had in mind for me things more beautiful than I could ever have even considered. Another thing that they began to get across to me that weekend, by the way, is the fact that I forfeited my right to live my life for myself. You know, selfish program my butt. We talked about, I don't remember whether it was when we were actually talking last night or maybe just when Ed and I were talking, but you know, this book says that as an ex-problem drinker, my very life, the book says, depends on the constant thought of others and what I can do to meet their needs. It doesn't depend on me. It depends on me working on my inner child so that I can get comfortable within myself. It depends on my constant thought of others and how I can meet their needs. And when I do that, Chuck C. says it so beautifully. Chuck C. says, hey, taking care of me is not my job. He said, my job is to help God's kids do what they need to have done for free and for fun because I want to. He said, that's my job, is to help God's kids. He said, God's job is to take care of me. And says, if I'll do my job, God's never late on his. You know, God'll be just right there. But you know, it is that last idea on 6 and 7. I lived my life for myself for 37 years and then really tried to live it for another 9 years, except I dressed it up spiritually. And I made about as big a mess out of that as a human being could make. So I forfeited my right to live life for myself. And when I come to my 6th and 7th step that way and say, hey, I already tried living it my way, and living it for me, and I ran her in the ditch. Now I'm going to try to live it your way, God. I'm going to try to live it with constant thought of others, and you just take that and make of it what you will. That's when the miracle happens. Why don't we take a potty break and come back and spend a few minutes on 8 and 9 break for the night. Into it with the prayer that I like to use, please. God, please help me to set aside everything that I think I know about myself, my illness, these steps, and especially you, for an open mind and a new experience with myself, my illness, and especially you. Amen. Thanks, fellas. Good news is that what I have to say about 8 and 9 really don't take very long, so we're just about done for the night. First thing that I want to say about 8 and 9 is going back to that same weekend in Cleveland, which has been such an important turning point for me in my sobriety. They talked to me a little bit about 8 and 9 that weekend. When they were explaining to me that I couldn't effectively work on those character defects and pray for them to be removed because I wanted them removed and because I wanted to be spiritual and I wanted to be comfortable, they took me through all the steps. They took me to that third step prayer. So, you know, God, please take away my difficulties, not so that I can be spiritual, but so that victory over them will bear witness to those I would help of your power, your love, and your way of life. With regard to the 8th and 9th step, they really tricked me on that. They said, Don, what's the purpose of your 8th and 9th step? And I said, well, the purpose of the 8th and 9th step is to clean up my past and put my life in order. And they said something to the effect of, you don't read very well, do you? And they referred me to page 77. Top of page 77, it says, at the moment, we are trying to put our lives in order. But this is not an end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. Just makes it extremely clear. Cleaning up my life is a byproduct of the main of the real purpose here, which is to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and those around me. And after we got to thinking about it, that's how 8 and 9 have worked in my life. That's how they have always worked. My life getting cleaned up really was something that, in a way, I didn't expect to happen. Like getting my law license back, it wasn't my objective to get my law license back. I really and truly was acting or trying to act like a fellow would act if it was simply his objective to set the ledger straight. And it was a byproduct of that my law license got cleaned up. I believe if it had been my objective to clean that up and get my law license back, I believe not only would I have never gotten it back, I believe I would have died of ego and alcoholism many years ago in the process of trying to do that. So I need to remember that this is not a psychological exercise of me cleaning up my life. This is me coming as a little child to this 8th and 9th step to try to follow the directions so that God will, in God's wisdom, fit me to be of maximum usefulness to Him and those around me. And I don't know what needs to be done with me in order to fit me to be of maximum usefulness to God and those around me. So when I approach these steps with that same attitude of I'm just going to follow the instructions, I'm going to do what I'm told to do here. First place, step 8, I was told by Cherry, is clearly a two-part step. The first part of step 8 is I make a list of persons I've harmed, a little different from the wording where it talks about the fourth step of people, institutions, or principles. The 8th step talks about making a list of persons that I've harmed. That's the first half of the 8th step. Cherry told me I needed to put down everybody that came to mind. He further told me, and I've read the book over and over, and it looks like old Cherry was right, The book doesn't tell me that I do any particular writing on the amends list other than just get the names of the persons that I've harmed down in writing on that amends list. Book tells me that referring back to my fourth step that I'll have all those names. Tells me it's somewhere in that fourth step I'll have a list of every, you know, I'll have to dig it out. Doesn't mean that I just use that same list. I refer to that in making my eighth step amends list. And then Cherry told me that it was extremely important, and I passed this along to everybody that I sponsor, that I don't even address the second half of the step, which is becoming willing to make amends to them all, until after I finish the first half. Because, see, if I'm thinking about the fact, man, a step and a half down the line, I got to go face this SOB and make amends to him, that SOB may not wind up on my amends list. You know, so I need to just stick to where I am. I don't have to be willing at all to make amends to him to put him on that list. And then it's real important, Cherry told me, that I meet with my sponsor between those two parts of that step. And a lot of things happened during that meeting. In the first place, I found out that in my case, and in the case of folks that come to me with their eighth step list, that there's usually a real big percentage of the people on there that don't really belong on that. Now, it was the right thing to do to write the names down there. But see, I put a whole bunch of people down there because I had showed my butt in front of those people, and I was terribly embarrassed. And I might have disgusted them a little bit, but as far as doing them any harm, I hadn't really done those people harm. What had really happened was that I had showed my butt and I had embarrassed myself. And what we talk about here is where we have done harm, where we have changed something for a person for the worse. And what we're talking about in amending it, Cherry explained to me that means to put it back as close to the way it was before we did our bad behavior as we possibly can. And as far as am I an other, you know, you hear that a lot. The ninth step says that we made direct amends to such persons except when to do so would injure them or others. Well, I was told by Cherry that he wasn't an other, and if I wanted to have any kind of comfortable sobriety, I better not be an other. Nothing in this book indicates that I am an other. But right on the other hand, a Siamese twin with that, is that nothing seems to need to be talked over with a sponsor more than going to somebody to make amends. Because, you see, if I get in this where I'm not focused that my purpose is just to let God fit me of maximum usefulness, and my purpose is to mend things for the other person, I don't have the right to get crap off my chest at somebody else's detriment. My Lord, and the book couldn't be more clear about this, I don't have the right to go to my neighbor and say, you don't know I've been sleeping with your wife, but I feel like I have to tell you this because I'm trying to stay sober and I've got to get it off my chest. Of course I don't have the right to do that. You know, that harms a lot of other people. And just because something harms me doesn't mean that it doesn't also harm other people. So that's why I need that input from that sponsor, for somebody that can listen to my insane idea, to my insane ideas that I think are common sense, can listen to it and say, no, Don, that's not common sense, Betty Rowe, that's an insane idea. Now, also, there's this overwhelming need to run and apologize to everybody when we're doing our ninth step. And somehow we get it confused that this is the ninth step. And the ninth step, I was sponsored, and in my experience, it has sometimes an aspect of apologizing. And when it has an aspect of apologizing, it's when I've done something affecting somebody with whom I have a personal relationship, and because I'm the one that did it, that has hurt their feelings. If I lifted a pair of sunglasses from a 7-Eleven store where I didn't know anybody working in there, what I need to do to set that situation back as close as I can to where it was before I did my bad act is come up with the best estimate I can of the monetary value of those sunglasses and get the money somehow, as best I can, to that store. I hadn't hurt anybody's feelings. They didn't know who I was. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if I've stolen something from my mother or from my friend, then I not only need to set that money thing right, that material thing right, but I have hurt that person. I have hurt their feelings. I have injured their feelings. And I need to go to them, and I need to do what I can to say, you know I betrayed our, relationship here. And I know that I hurt you, and I want to do whatever I can to set that right. Because then that becomes part of the making of amends. What Cherry told me, he used an example of shooting a cow. He said that if when I'm drinking I have shot your cow, I may or may not need to apologize to you for shooting your cow. If you didn't know me, if I'm just another yap off the street and I just shot your cow, then the damage I've done to you is your cow's gone. On the other hand, if you knew me and you trusted me and I was a guest at your farm and I betrayed that and I killed your cow while I was there, yes, I have hurt you other than the value of the cow and what the cow was worth, and I need to go to you and I need to try to mend that, to put it back as close to the way it was. But Cherry said, in either situation, whether it's somebody that you knew and hurt their feelings to, or whether it was a stranger where you just deprived them of a cow, it's pretty sure that you need to drop them off a quart of milk every once in a while. You know, need to do what I need to replace what it is that I took. Put things back as close as I can. One of the most, I guess, out of context quoted things in the big book is at the end of the ninth step, right before we get to the promises. And anybody that's been around any period of time at all has heard somebody quoting, I don't have to take that. Big book tells me I don't crawl before anybody. Well, big book does tell me that. But we seem to forget the sentence that comes before that. The sentence that comes immediately before that, and all this is immediately before if we are painstaking, the beginning of the promises. It says we should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. And then it says, after I've been considerate, after I've been tactful, after I've been sensible, and after I've been humble, beyond that, I don't have to crawl. But it's so easy, and I think so many times we forget, and we just grab hold of that. I don't have to crawl for anybody. By God, I'm one of God's people. Well, I don't, as long as I've complied with the sentence before and done all those things, and that's very important. You know, we pick these things up, and it's just human nature. We do it, and we pick up something in this big book that is a soft and loving thing to be used to help other people, and we use it like a club. You know, we do that sometimes with rigorous honesty. Cherry taught me that honesty without compassion isn't honesty at all. All it is a subtle hostility. That the only honesty that counts with me is when I've got compassion that goes with it. And he also taught me that honesty. He said, Don, you don't need to waste a world of time agonizing over the details of self-honesty. He said, if you'll just make real sure that you are honest with everybody around you, that will cause some self-honesty to happen inside you. Said self-honesty is not as clear a thing as honesty with other people. But he said, whatever you do, don't neglect doing the honesty with other people while you are agonizing over and examining your self-honesty within yourself. says, because it's apt to work that if you get honest with other folks, that just sort of automatically makes you get honest with yourself. Then he gave me a definition of a lie that I hated at the time, and I still don't like that sucker. I mean, but it's an awful effective definition for me. Cherry told me that any time that I intend for someone to believe or continue to believe that a fact, is different than I know that fact to be, I'm lying whether I've opened my mouth or not. Now, that's kind of a harsh standard in a lot of ways. But then on the other hand, by limiting it to the facts, Cherry made it clear to me that I'm not anointed by God and not in danger of getting drunk, that I don't search out every woman that's wearing an ugly dress and tell her she's wearing an ugly dress. And further, Cherry indicated to me that the rigorous honesty that this book's talking about doesn't require me to tell her it's ugly, even if she asks me. Because my opinion of that dress is not a fact. And I'm not obliged to share my opinions with anybody, whether they ask me or not. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't do some real gut-level sharing in this program and with people who are not in the program. So don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that we don't ever need to express our honest feelings. But I don't have the right to spew any opinion of mine all over anybody when that is hurtful to them. You know, if after praying and using the 11th step on it, it seems like the right thing to do to go ahead and tell somebody what I think or what I feel, and I do it in a loving, compassionate way, you know, not in another damn thing, then that's okay. But I need to understand that I don't ever need to actively try to cause you to believe that a fact is other than I know it to be, and I don't need to actively ever try to get you to continue to believe that a fact is other than I know it to be. Because when I'm doing that, Cherry told me I was lying whether I opened my mouth or not. And see, I didn't like that definition. There are days when I still don't like it, but it's been an awfully effective definition for me.
Say it one more time.
Oh, that any time I am actively trying to get someone to believe that a fact is different than I know it to be, or I'm actively trying to get them to continue to believe that a fact is different than I know that fact to be, I'm lying. Whether I'm saying anything or not, I'm lying. I'm dishonest. Once we have done this, fellas, we will have recovered. According to this book, we will be in a state of recovery for alcoholism. And the book also tells us that what these steps are is their process of ego deflation. And by this point, we will have followed the instructions well enough that God will have done the miracle of recovery in us. And our ego will be deflated to the point where God will come in. Cherry also proceeded to tell me that, yes, this is true, but that the human ego is the most resilient thing in the universe. It always reasserts itself, and it never stays deflated. Cherry talked to me about one of us dying in a gutter. And if you just think about it, this is true. You know, when one of us dies in the gutter, we don't die with the awareness that we are completely useless, flotsam and jetsam. We lay there misunderstood and smarter than people around us and mistreated by other people and just real, real special. You just can't do much with that human ego. That sucker will always keep coming back. And that's why we're going to talk tomorrow about having to live every day of our life on 10, 11, and 12. Because that sucker's going to keep coming back. Cherry also taught me, and I believe this with all my heart, it's been true in my experience. All character defects are reoccurring. All character defects are reoccurring. I haven't had a thing that's just been totally lifted out of me and completely gone with no vestige of it ever visiting me again. Now, they reoccur with less commanding force. Sometimes they're not even uncomfortable when they reoccur. You know, sometimes they reoccur and I can just kind of chuckle at it because I'm not going to do that. You know, and I know on that day that I'm not going to do that. But as far as it just being lifted out of me completely, as far as my feelings go and my brains go, no, that old crazy picture show that we were talking about last night just keeps right on rolling. And I need to understand that my recovery is not extinguishing the crazy picture show, but learning that I don't have to obey it. And learning that I don't have to build a shrine to every feeling and every desire that I have. That I can acknowledge that I have it, determine it's not a good idea to act on it, and just go on. And that's about all I've got to say about 8 and 9, fellows, and from my standpoint, we'll start up tomorrow.